Lawrence, thank you for coming on. You've lived an amazing life. You survived the Second World War. You grew up during a very grey 1950s England, and as a young boy, moved to a very colourful Mexico with your family. You've been on great adventures through Indonesia, Ring of Fire, took David Bowie, Mick Jagger and Richard Branson on those journeys. And here we are today in a global pandemic. Have you ever experienced anything like this before?
No, not at all. And this is a fantastic opportunity. And it's, of course, happens every 100 years or so. And we're lucky that it's happened in our lifetimes. And it is quite extraordinary, isn't it? Never at any one time has the whole planet, A, gone into lockdown, and B, not gone and worshipped. You know, people have gone to Mecca for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they've gone to the Vatican for hundreds and hundreds of years. And now everybody has to do it alone, including the most important things, which you would think was communing with their essence. So indeed, this is a magical and extraordinary occasion that gives everybody an opportunity, I think, to stop. Do you remember that movie that says, "Stop the world, I want to get off"? Well, it's a little bit like that at the moment, to me it seems at least. And we suddenly realized how fast everything was moving and how we were caught in a momentum that seemed unstoppable. And now at least we have a chance to feed our own souls, you know? We're all in this alone together. We're all in this together alone, which is an incredibly creative opportunity to be in, I like to think. And one of the other interesting things that's happened during this pandemic is, remember, we've become very addicted to the international media, which is telling us rather negative stories all the time. It isn't really an interesting story unless it's a bit negative as far as they're concerned. And also what's happened in the last at least 20 years or so, primarily in America, but in many other places in the world, is the loss of authority. Nobody believes authority anymore. In fact, they don't take science very seriously, or haven't done. They haven't taken the truth very seriously, because a good story sells more than a truthful, boring story, which is one of the reasons, possibly, that we have this extraordinary president in the United States, and one of the reasons, too, that nobody knows quite which authority to turn to. In the past, we knew that the medicine or science would have been something which would have been the final authority. But since science has been undermined over these years, suddenly we're hoist on our own petard, and we have to see, it's taken quite a few weeks, quite a few months, before the true scientists have begun emerging out of this rubble. And we have a chance to listen to alternatives to the orthodox voice about what is true and what is false and what is valuable, what is significant.
And do you feel, with this new available space that we have of reflection, you know, what you mentioned, we're in this together, and maybe that will lead to new ways of thinking. Do you feel there could be a planetary awakening in terms of people waking up to knowing that this could be a warning to a future crisis that might not be as easily repairable, i.e. a climate crisis that we're under? Do you feel this could be a bit of a wake-up call for that?
Oh, so definitely so. And it's not as if it's a new thing. I think these ideas of regeneration and of the value of the planet and of the meaning of our own inner existence have been there and have been gathering steam. It's just that they never had a chance to come out. And now, under these circumstances, they really do have a chance to express themselves. And we see a lot of people doing it. We see a lot of people being creative at home and sharing it with everybody else. And we also see how all these creatures are coming out and inhabiting their world now that we've left them alone. We've seen how the environment has got so much cleaner in such an amazingly short period of time. I've just been reading it's like 17% cleaner air than it was globally like just a few months ago. So we can see in a way how quickly things revert back to the natural state without our hysterical interference. And it isn't as if they're new ideas that are about to be seeded. These have been seeded already. They were seeded in the 60s. Arguably, they were seeded at the turn of the century. In the 1800s, people began realizing that the path of science was rather a negative one by itself. It could be entirely destructive of the planet. Whereas we now have every reason to show ourselves just how much we have lost in the last 100 years. in terms of tribal peoples and creatures and the purity of the waters and things like that. We couldn't be at a better time to have a lockdown. Couldn't be better timing now than having this coronavirus attack us all.
Okay, so that's an interesting point in regards to how quickly nature is repairing itself. And of course, all of the answers do potentially lie in nature. The fundamentals of us being humans, we're part of nature. It's something we've maybe forgotten a little bit along on our journey, that the fact that we are all interconnected, not just within ourselves as humans, but to yes. nature and the order of things.
Yes.
Do you feel it's time to maybe look a little bit closer again at nature and what we can learn?
Absolutely. Amazingly recently that we have seen ourselves as animals again. For at least since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we decided we weren't animals. We were a cut above the animals, supported by our religious literature that we weren't animals. But in fact, it's become quite clear that we are animals and part of everything else, and that we can't control nature quite as much as we think we can. As soon as we began flying aeroplanes around the country and building dams and giant ships, we thought we had nature licked, basically. And there's nothing like a little tiny virus to come along to show us how little control we really have when we're up against the whole organism of the earth itself. And I think one of the other things we might have learned is, you know, we tend to combat viruses with the thought that this is a war and we're going to fight these creatures, forgetting we're already full of viruses. Our microbiomes are the equivalent of viruses, you know, they're forms of bacteria, as it were, and they keep us alive. And without them, there are tons of functions we couldn't carry on. So it isn't a matter of killing the viruses and getting rid of them, fighting battles with them. It's a matter of finding a bit of balance with them, a bit of order with them. And we have watched how the world has initially responded to this virus as a battle. And we have responded with fear, because if you like, it's the first time in history, these last 100 years, that we have ever been as safe as we are, that our medical technology has made us safer than we have ever been before. So obviously we're going to get the psychological corollary of that, of fear. And that fear has been stoked in the media. All the good stories are frightening stories, and the first stories about the coronavirus are ones of fear. And it's been easy to drive us all into the burrows of our homes. I think under the false understanding that we can escape this virus. But when you figure that, for instance, the Lapps in Lapland, even those who've never traveled in an aeroplane and who know nobody else who've traveled in an aeroplane, something like 70% of them have this virus, and that something like 65% of all the wild wolves in the Yellowstone National Park also have this virus, why do we think that wearing a mask and staying at home is going to prevent us from this? We're swimming in a sea of viruses. So the best thing to do, yes, okay, we will lose the old and the weak, but when haven't we, since the dawn of time? And the other problem about controlling nature, that false illusion that we control things, has been that we can control death, that it never really gets us. We've avoided that whole business of death, and we still try and avoid it. And it's extraordinary in a way that, you know, our fear of terrorism is what has made international plane travel absolute misery for the last 10 years. Whereas it might be time to realize that life has always been a bit of a risk. It's worth taking a little bit more of a risk if one wants to live with broader horizons.
It's interesting, the subject of death, and how in the West we do fear death. No one really thinks about it or tries to sort of, we always sort of imagine that we'll never die in many cases. But here in Bali, it's different. People almost sort of, not that they celebrate death, but they view death as a sort of gateway to the next passage.
Definitely.
And you've traveled a lot extensively around the whole world, but particularly Indonesia, which was well documented in Ring of Fire. What lessons do you think we can learn from those ancient tribes and those ancient civilizations in terms of how they live with nature, their outlook on death and life? And do you feel there's something which we can look back upon and bring into our modern lives?
Yes, because the tribal peoples are the last of the living peoples who have a memory of how we have all lived since the beginning of time, which is in the is recognizing that we are animals, that we're part of the animal community, and that other animals have special contributions to our life, and they can be spirit guides and things like this, wonderfully alive in the tribes of Indonesia, at least until the 70s and 80s. And I think, too, the complete difference between the way the Indonesians say, not even the tribal people, but the local people in Bali think, as opposed to us Westerners, is that in the West we try to control things. I mean, it always amazed me when I was commuting between my house in LA and my house in Indonesia. When I was back in LA, my television was always telling me how to close off my house, how to protect it, how to use poisons to kill any incoming creatures. Whereas back in Bali, we weren't even allowed to move into a new home before the spiders and the geckos had moved in first. So one is the way of control, and the other is the way of surrender. And they're both useful, they're both necessary at different times. But when it comes to a massive global virus like this, Corona-19, I think there's a lot to be learned from the way of surrender, because that is the soonest way that you're going to get herd immunity. Yes, people are going to die, but, sorry, that is the way it works. So we have a lot to learn from these people about our subordinate state in this naturally balanced ecology of the planet.
And another thing on this subject of nature, another thing that we may have forgotten is the fact of what nature gives us medicinally, whether that's in the form of plants. I mean, mushroom is one area which I'm particularly fascinated in at the moment.
Yes.
Not only as a medicine, but also as a gateway of different ways of thinking or different realities. Have you got much history or knowledge on that subject?
Well, a little bit, because I was a great fan and I was a telephone friend of Terence McKenna, who was the great guru of really transformational thinking through mushrooms, as you know, through psychedelic mushrooms, admittedly, even though there are many other uses of mushrooms now, as you say, as building materials and all sorts of things. And it's worth remembering, too, that it is the mushrooms, the rhizomes on the roots of trees that enables them to communicate electrically with each other all over the place. So this is why this recent wonderful work, The Hidden Life of Trees, where we realize they have memories, they can count, they know how many of them are left in their clump, and that one will react to another one's danger, because they're communicating through the equivalent of a nervous system, which are indeed mushrooms. And then, of course, Terence McKenna was rather cool about it from his standpoint. He said that you open up, it's through the psychedelic awarenesses brought by mushrooms, that you see what's going on, that you achieve a state of evolution whereby you can understand that we are here alive in this incredible mixture of life. I remember he also remarked that these mushrooms have tiny spores. They're the only spores from planet Earth that can drift through space. They're even covered, colored ultraviolet that deflects the ultraviolet harmful rays from space. They can move through space for incredibly long periods of time. And then they can fall into planets where they can germinate and they can turn into mushrooms, which, if there is a species around that is at the right stage in its evolution, can eat it and see who it is.
Wow.
That's an amazing observation of Terence.
Fascinating. It's interesting that the subject of using mushroom as material as well.
Yes.
And it's interesting, there's a guy called Paul Stamets who was also a friend of Terence McKenna, and he talks about mushrooms literally saving the world. They've got a billion years of wisdom, the oldest living organism, and they're a great replacement for plastics, leathers, all of these things. So I think there's a lot we can learn from these mushrooms and use and with modern technology as well.
Yes.
To actually replace a lot of the things that are killing the planet. And also there's things like seaweed now and people experimenting with different plant-based products.
Definitely.
Which could help sort of build a more greener world.
That's right.
And another guy who I know you're friends with, the late great Buckminster Fuller, So you met Bucky Fuller here in Bali, correct?
I met him in the States. Funnily enough, I never was with him here in Bali, but I met him in Boulder, Colorado, and I spent time with him in Los Angeles as well. Quite a lot of family time with him as well, because one of his close friends, his son-in-law, was actually quite a good friend of mine, so I was lucky enough to sort of hang out with him and eat with him and everything, and had already been deeply influenced by his work before I met him, and then was deeply touched by what an extraordinary, humble fellow, because he was really quite small and a little bit round, and he had no hair, and he had these big owl-like glasses. Everything he said was mind-blowing. And he had great respect for the Balinese. When he first came here, he was telling me that there's something very special about them, because they have been with their environment for so long that they have learned to work with the environment, which indeed they do. And he said they were very open to, of course, learning about things like geodesics, because they already have three-dimensional geodesics in their basketry here. So it isn't much of a leap to turn them into three-dimensional geodesic thinking and dome theology, as it were.
And do you think, because almost the Balinese have literally, just in everyday life, been making sacred geometry in baskets, in weaving, in fabrics, do you think this is just because they're closer to nature, or do you think there's a deliberate way or a deliberate meaning behind why those patterns are significant in daily life here? Where do you think that sort of stems from?
I think it stems from nature, because nature itself follows certain environmental, ecological, structural laws, which in a way is all Bucky Fuller pulled out and developed. And it was the Greeks who realized that there's a basic grammar of five primary three-dimensional figures, the polyregular polyhedra. And from those, in a sense, all three-dimensional form can be generated. Rather, as you only get X amount of notes on the spectrum of sound from which all music derives, or letters, in our case, in the English language, from which all these wonderful thought forms can be derived. But by living very close to nature, you do follow the way the bamboo goes, and you do follow the way certain sorts of trees produce certain sorts of leaves that require to be bound in this way rather than that way. Rather, as if you work with knots, as I occasionally do, there are certain twines that you cannot do that knot with. It bends in the wrong direction. So, too, with natural fibers, you are forced to move it in this direction, and that gives rise to larger and larger versions of what is happening at the microcosmic level in terms of form and shape and structure. And Bucky Fuller recognized that, and that's basically what he did. His wonderful geodesic geometry springs from the world's simplest sacred geometry that is found in all living and non-living things.
And the vibration, which essentially the universe is made up of, one large vibration, is that connected to these sacred geometries and these things that you mentioned in music, when you look at the shapes that are made from things like somatics, these things are all connected into one thing? Like, how does that, just for anyone that doesn't really know much about the subject, how is that all connected?
Well, you even the Greeks discovered that the proportions at which you stop a vibrating string are related to the mathematical proportions of certain numbers that go into each other. So physical form and vibrationary frequency are demonstrably terribly close together. And some of them are chaotic and disruptive and against our own natures and are dissonant. And other ones are supportive of it and creative of it. And yes, that is very much, one likes to think that is part of this connectivity is part of the energy that we have an opportunity to awaken ourselves or sensitize ourselves to again under these circumstances of being so-called shut down. Whereas shut down, locked down, sounds awfully negative. And I guess for a lot of people who don't get to experience any greenery at all where they're shut down, that must be particularly difficult. But at least they have the opportunity of going in, and it has been argued that inwards is in fact where you find the window of everything connected. whereas outwardly you don't necessarily recognize it. So it's necessary to drive us inward. I would have thought this was an incredibly positive moment in planetary awareness, that the entire planet at the same time is forced to go in and find what is insignificant to it, to each one of us. And instead of going out and doing our practicing our religion with groups of other people, where it sort of gets off track a bit, let's face it, it's an opportunity for people to go inwards on their own with their own communities. And the other interesting thing about this lockdown, I think, is your relationships, your relationship with your family. I mean, we don't read much about what havoc it has created amongst married couples. But there's a vast amount of disruption there, because you are forced to face what your relationship is. You have to live with it rather than have it cushioned by the outside community. And your relationship with your children, a lot of people don't have anything to do with their children all their lives, and it begins quite early on in their life. Well, this is a chance to be the animals that we are.
To reconnect with each other and realize the fundamentals of what it means to be human.
And arguably, it also gives a different sort of slant on love, because there's a lot of bullshit written about love and spoken about love, and it's an abstract and all this and the other. But a lot of it has to do just simply with touch and with being, walking around barefooted or even naked in your garden. It puts you back in touch with who we are, with who our roots are. Which are all things that have been forgotten in the outside world. And just to repeat myself slightly, this business of authority, it seems to me is extraordinary. We now have to find our own authority. What are we going to follow? Because our great heroes are undermined, you know? I mean, even the doctors, I'm thinking of Fauci. I mean, he too is a target nowadays. Justifiably, maybe our whole attitude towards how we deal with an international virus like this is wrong. I think it is. I think we're going to have to eventually be driven back in the not too distant future to quite simply acquiring herd immunity, which is at the sacrifice of the elderly and the weak, but it is part of the process of how evolution has worked since the beginning of time. And that gives us herd immunity and strength and the ability to find our balance and walk the tightrope of health in an ocean of conflicting viruses.
Yeah, so it's fascinating when we talk about vibrational energy and sacred geometry, and these things that we can't physically see, or certainly not through our lens. You talk often about the invisible world. Now, what is that exactly?
The invisible world is virtually almost everything. It's wonderful that we don't actually see the world as it is, isn't it? All we're picking up is the vibrationary frequencies on our optical nerves of what is out there. We're not actually seeing what is out there itself. And when we talk about the invisible world, how about our world of music and sound, which is so rich and so much a part of our life? We don't see that at all. And then people have laughed at the Balinese, for instance, who spend so much of their time as celebrating so-called invisible worlds of demons and gods, whereas we, of course, are rather worried about the invisible world of the virus at the moment. None of us have ever seen this virus. Do we ever know it existed? Or are we just taking somebody else's word for it? I mean, we probably could see it if we looked under a microscope. But even then, how does that help us? Who would think that such a tiny little thing could affect us so deeply? So indeed, it's more to do with what can be seen with the mind than what can be seen with the eyes. And there is one sense of the invisible world of being literally the world of spirit or of energies. Let's come back briefly, for instance, to the trees, the hidden life of trees. We had no idea what invisible worlds were taking place within the tree community until recent research shows how alive and how aware they are. So that is a form of invisible world. And of great interest to me is this thing that I natter on about every so often, which is like what's called distributed intelligence or emergent behavior. And this is when you get large groups of a single species of creature all together. or even large arrays of computers hooked up together, and you begin to get more than the sum of their parts. They begin by behaving like more than the sum of their parts. They begin behaving like another creature. There are enough individual parts of them, like there are enough individual parts of a brain for it suddenly to begin functioning as a brain or something else. Now, that is a hidden world, a hidden dimension of consciousness that begins manifesting itself after a while. Also interesting to me, you know, this virus, science doesn't even think it's alive. One of the main reasons they don't figure it meets the criteria for life is because it can't reproduce itself. It can only reproduce in the bodies of other creatures. I don't see why that should prevent it from being alive. How come it's so clever? How come it's already mutating? How come that we've already got various varieties of it adapted to different people in different geographical parts of the globe? It shows all the qualities of something that's alive in consciousness, and yet it is brainless and not even DNA, it's only RNA. So it is very primitive. But it too is driven by its own deep memory for survival. And you might even say that the viruses are the oldest things on the planet. Of all the tribes of life on the planet, they must have the longest memories, because they were in the boiling waters long before people or creatures of any type had climbed onto the land. And yet now we have the hubris to say they're not even alive, these things, whereas they have been not only part of life ever since the beginning, but they have integrated into the RNA of other living creatures since the beginning. So surely have a memory of everything we've ever been. They might even, in a sense, be guardians of harmony and wipe out creatures that have got too big for their boots. There are examples of them having attacked us ever since the beginning. You know, there were diseases, for instance, that attacked us in Neolithic times and reduced us to bottlenecks of a few thousand individuals. And then they came again in different guises, you know, in the case of the bubonic plague or Black Death, they turned up riding in the disguise of the virus that's hiding in the saliva of the bubonic flea that in turn was riding on the rats, the black rats that invaded Europe. So it may be the same sort of balancing phenomena, which is also part of the invisible world of emergent intelligence and consciousness that we know nothing about yet, because it's only 2020.
So it's very much the natural rhythm of nature, which we almost have to accept and just get on with. And
so, yes.
Yeah. And on the subject of that and on the virus, what's your thoughts? There's a lot of talk at the moment on vaccines. There's actually a lot of people going to jail for speaking their mind and having opinions. It seems like a very dangerous thing. It could be potentially a very dangerous time. So in one way, it could be very positive. It could bring around a huge, big shift in consciousness. Planetary awakening, which we can all try and learn from.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it could, you know, governments and authoritarian measures could use this as an opportunity to implement things that wouldn't usually, under normal circumstances, get implemented. What's your thoughts on some of the things that's going on at the moment in terms of the silencing, people getting put in prison? Do you feel that could be a worry as we move out of this pandemic?
Well, it is, as you say, it has brought into sharp focus this business of what is democracy too, and how much freedom should you allow a democracy, even if it kills itself. I mean, what it seems to me that this attack, so-called attack by the virus, has done for us, it has fundamentally changed our relationship to governments, to the planet, to each other, and to ourselves. To what do we personally, individually, think about things? What is our position on things? Which do we consider to be the truth of all these conflicting claims to be the truth? And it is interesting indeed that some people are risking jail or certainly being shut down. Judy, what's her name? Mikovits is the one I'm thinking of at the moment, who was already jailed and she was gagged for 5 years. She could not talk about what she was doing. She was in business with Fauci, and she is a highly trained, highly articulate virologist. Why can't we listen to what she has to say and come to our own conclusions about it? Now, the degree to which people are prepared to fight for hearing other people, even if they're nonsense, is the degree to which we're going to be able to come out of this with greater rather than lesser freedoms. I don't think that the over culture is going to enslave us. I think there are too many people thinking for themselves. I think there are too many revolutionaries. And I like to think that they still have in them a memory of the 60s, which was a real revolution in the 60s. And it sprung from initially the hatred of the war in Vietnam, which was an unjust war. And it was appallingly badly carried out. I mean, defoliation, if you think about it, trying to wipe out everybody's greenery in another country is a horrific thing to do to anybody. And, you know, some cultures, especially certain decades, the 90s maybe, the 2010s, look back on the so-called hippie alternative culture as a negative time in our history. Whereas it's so, in my view, obviously being an old ex-hippie myself, I would be obviously arguing for the other side of things, but it was in that period, if you think about it, that were born such movements as Save the Planet, Preserve the Forests, equality amongst people, sexual, racial equality amongst people, and also political, you know, the Amnesty International was born then, Save the Whales was born then. They were a premonition of what is now absolutely vital if we are to survive. Then it would have been a luxury to have had those things realized. Now it is an absolute essential thing to have them realized. And especially this business of environmentalism, fascinating stuff that doesn't get enough play footage in my, you know this guy Zach Bush, have you seen anything about him? He is, it sounds a bit boring because he's an agronomist by training, he's also a doctor, but he talks about the earth, the actual physical earth of the planet, the soil of the planet, and it's kind of hard to listen to, they're quite long, but they are brilliant interviews, and he is a clear, he is like an earth swami, a guru of our planet. And he's a new voice to watch. I think he'll be very famous. And because he links all these things together, but from the perspective of how we have destroyed the actual soil of the planet to a very large degree with these chemicals all over the planet over the last decade or so. And it is an approach that is also taken by Big Pharma towards our own bodies. It is the opposite to the holistic, environmentally friendly, a sensitive and surrendering approach of nature. So these are voices that can be heard. They're voices that have taken the voices of the 60s a whole quantum leap further. And I think it's what we should be ready to embrace. And if the wrong forces try and take back their power again, when we are released from this virus, I think a lot of us should be prepared to deny them that.
Yeah, so the spirit of the 60s is one which, as you mentioned, it opened up the doors of possibilities. And I think that people, you know, over the course of the last 50, 60 years or whatever, the hippie movement was tarnished a little bit with, you know, drug taking. They weren't taken very seriously,
right.
But actually, not just in the open-mindedness of that generation, but they were the first to use, or you guys were the first to use certain technologies, you know, and it led to people like Steve Jobs creating Apple and all these things. So it was actually a very progressive movement in a lot of different ways. And the people from that era, like yourself, carry a certain spirit just in your daily life. And I know that you've worked a lot with David Bowie and Mick Jagger over the years, and David Bowie is a big hero of mine as an artist, but also as a thinker. What do you think, what was in the air at that time, do you think, for these people like yourself and these great artists and thinkers to sort of come out and fight against it? Was it the war? Was there other factors that played into that? And how do you think we can sort of take that energy and learn from, you know, that the past for today's world?
Well, I think they were revolutionaries. I mean, they were revolutionaries in the music world, but their hearts were revolutionary hearts. And I was lucky. I mean, I never worked with them. I just played with them. And we got on well together because, in a sense, my brother and I were revolutionaries as well. We went out and we were got stuck into the jungle and the tribal peoples. That was our way of expressing what was going on. But yes, we had the same sort of instincts of rejection of the passivity of the planet in the face of obvious regression and destruction, and needed to open up and sing about it and stand up and shout about it. I don't know, it's rather hard to discuss your own generation. It's as hard as it is for a fish to discuss the water it's swimming around in. All I can tell you, it was a feeling. It was a zeitgeist, as they call it, which was one of exuberant rejection of the status quo. And I like to think that's what we have to do again now, because the status quo has taken us deep into destructive and dangerous territory. And in a way, even those who were much involved in that have had a chance over recent months to sit back and see, well, what have they been dedicating their lives to? People in the oil business, you know, people in this economic delusion that you can carry on growing every single year, when anywhere in nature you can see nothing grows forever. It's a pulse of inwards and outwards. And yet here we are, all subjected to this absolute nonsense that we have to carry on every single year growing our GDP by a bit more than we did last time. And other things that have perhaps escaped our attention in the noise and din of the media. Like, we haven't heard much about the population of the planet recently. Why do people not talk about how overpopulating we were coming? It was a big deal to talk about that in the 60s. Population bomb, there were big things. But now nobody really mentions it. Why? Well, I'm not going to tell you why, because I think everybody should begin exploring for themselves why. Why are things kept quiet? Because there are big interests that are concerned in us not concentrating too much on really vital truths. I mean, certainly energy is one of those as well. I mean, even Michael Moore's film, I don't know if you had a chance to see that, that was taken off the air too. I mean, that was busted, taken off YouTube for at least 10 days, but the subsequent noise meant that it went back on again.
Wow, I did not know that got taken down. I mean, isn't that crazy? I mean, what's happened to free speech, you know? That's unbelievable that would get taken down.
Obviously, one can criticize the film. It is a bit out of date. It does give us a rather bleak view of what can be achieved through unsustainable resources. It's a little out of date, but how dare anybody stop me from making my own decision about somebody else's work as to whether or not they think it's any good? That's what we've got to look out for in this day and age of being online.
Yeah, I think that's what could easily creep up on us in the current crisis. Everybody allowing these things to happen because it's for the good of everybody to not spread fake news.
Exactly.
And when you look at Trump and his, you know, they're really pushing this agenda of fake news. It's constantly ramming it down people's throats.
That's right.
And no one knows who do you believe, you
know?
That's it. And as you mentioned, this generation, they don't really have a voice that they can look up to and of reasoning.
There's no final authority anymore. And that is the price of us not taking the truth seriously over the last 20 years. That is why news shows have become fictional presentations. They've been concentrating on things that are often lies and certainly don't deserve that much strength. Why? Because they give us an emotional frisson. Because on the same old thing, you know, a happy story is no story at all for the news. Therefore, we concentrate on the negative. And that's one of the reasons we've elected somebody who isn't a serious president either. He's just a good showman. And therefore, authority, we don't know who to turn to anymore, except to ourselves, to our own common sense, and then subsequently to other groups of people, kindred souls, who've been coming to their own conclusions by themselves. which is another reason to not allow anybody to stop us from reading or viewing whatever we damn well like.
And in the 60s and 70s as well, that there was music was very much the medium that attracted a lot of people, and the revolutionaries, you know, you had John Lennon, you had David Bowie's of the world, who really stood for something and used music as the medium. Here we are today, where there's some great music being made, don't get me wrong, but it hasn't got that same feeling of it being new or progressive or any way. Do you feel that there'll be some sort of new medium that
with the arts, not only music, but a lot of the arts in the movie business, which I'm in, it has been managed by money people. It has been controlled by the non-artists because they consider that to be more important than the art itself. It's what can you make back from it? So it has rather suppressed the real arts themselves. Whereas this is an opportunity for especially the artistic community to be creative themselves and to not be lent on and knocked out of shape, or have their work knocked out of shape by financial overlords. I mean, this is why Hollywood, frankly, isn't producing any interesting films at all, because over the last 10 days, with the loss of authority and the loss of the interest in science, you see, scientists are not taken seriously anymore. This is why you have this big confusion in the States now. It's opening up in certain areas while the curve is still rising. So it's complete mixed chaos. Yet, in Hollywood, we're not seeing interesting films at all because they submitted to the money guys telling them how to do their job, telling the artists how to do their job. Things have got out of balance.
Absolutely. I think in the current state of solidarity, that will bring hopefully a new wave of creativity when people are at home, alone, isolating themselves. We hope that this breeds almost a new generation or a new way of thinking. And it could potentially be one of the most creative periods of our time.
Certainly could.
So it will be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Certainly could indeed.
Yeah. Great, Lawrence. So just to end on the podcast series, have you got any messages? Just one final message to send out to maybe kids who are growing up today in terms of your learnings of living your life, and what positive messages could you, or advice could you give to the younger generation coming through today?
Well, that you are lucky to have lived through this extraordinary COVID-19 year or two. Don't expect the disease to go away. It's going to be another of the things that we live with on this planet. I think it will always be here to some degree or another. It's nothing to be feared any more than death is to be feared. And you're lucky to have lived through it because it has given us all a pause to sit back on our haunches and see what are the more important things in life. And whether for the remaining relatively few years in our tiny little existences we have left, what we're prepared to put our energy into. And it is a wonderful, fascinating world which we know incredibly little about. It's early in history, we're primitive little savages, all of us still, and we haven't awakened to the majestic effulgence of light that is taking place all around us all the time.
Amazing. Lawrence, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Been absolutely fascinating as always. Great to see you. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
And yeah.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.